Well, our subject this evening is modern art. And modern art is something that many of us have difficulty relating to. For the most part, we are used to thinking of art as being something which depicts things we are familiar with. So, for example, art may be a picture of a person, which is a portrait, or a picture of a place, which is a landscape, or a picture of a bowl of fruit, right, which is a still life. We're used to being able to look at a painting, and I'm going to be talking about paintings almost exclusively tonight. In fact, quite exclusively. We're used to being able to look at a painting, see something we recognize in it, because the painting is a representation of that thing. And this is representational art. But you know, along in the early years of this century, in the years just before the First World War, another kind of art emerged in Europe, a kind of art which is called abstract. And that sort of art is not a picture of anything which we can recognize. If one looks at an abstract painting, what one sees are colors and shapes and lines and textures, but no object that we can recognize. So that abstract art seems to have no meaning. It seems to have no content. But the fact is that one of the greatest of all modern abstract artists, indeed he has been called the father of modern abstract art, was a Russian named Vasily Kandinsky. And Kandinsky wrote a book called Concerning the Spiritual in Art, in which I might add, he talked about Theosophy and the Theosophical Society and Madame Blavatsky. And in that book, Kandinsky also said that a painting without content is decoration merely, fit for neckties and carpets only. Kandinsky thought that all of his paintings, including his abstract paintings, which are not pictures of anything we can recognize, he thought nevertheless that they had meaning and content. And so the question is, what is that meaning and content which Kandinsky saw in his own abstract paintings and other abstract artists have seen in their work? That's what I'd like to explore with you this evening. In addition to dividing all art into representational, which is pictures of things we can recognize, and abstract, which is pictures of nothing we can recognize, we can also divide all art into what we might call exoteric and esoteric art. Or perhaps we could say literal art, art which depicts what you see and whose meaning is what you see on the canvas, and symbolic art, right, which has a meaning other than what we see on the canvas. Now, clearly, some representational art is simply literal, is it not? If one sees a portrait of a famous person, then the chances are that portrait is literal representational art. It's meant to depict the person whose portrait we see and nothing more. But then some representational art has, in addition to the meaning which is obvious on the canvas, it has another meaning underneath. It has a symbolic meaning. And that same distinction is true of abstract art, of non-representational art. And this evening, I'm not going to be talking at all about that abstract art which is literal. And there is such art, which is just color and line and figure and texture and nothing more. That I'm not going to be concerned with this evening. Rather, I'm going to be concerned with the kind of abstract art which has an esoteric or symbolic meaning to it. Kandinsky, in his little book concerning the spiritual in art, as I said, talked about Theosophy and the Society and Madame Blavatsky and Rudolf Steiner, who at that time was head of the Theosophical Society in Germany, and a number of such ideas. And Kandinsky made it perfectly clear that his inspiration for art came from what these persons had written about the world and how it is. And Kandinsky thought that in doing his abstract paintings, he was, in fact, expressing the esoteric or inner side of things. And we'll see, I hope this evening, you will see how that might be. Among other things, although Kandinsky did not mention them, we know that he was influenced by Annie Besant and C.W. Leadbeater, because we know that Kandinsky read a little book by those two authors called Thought Forms. Thought Forms by Besant and Leadbeater is a book about how our thoughts look to a clairvoyant eye. We live in an environment which is not simply the physical environment of air and water and earth, but we live in an environment of emotions, of feelings, do we not? And we live in an environment of thoughts, of mental activity. And the feelings and the thoughts which you and I have can influence other persons, can they not? Have you ever walked in a room where you could sense the atmosphere was tense, or where you could sense profound peace and harmony? The thoughts and emotions we have affect those in the world around us. And that's what Besant and Leadbeater's little book, Thought Forms, is about. It describes those worlds of emotion and of thought as being composed of matter, of a kind of matter much more rarefied, much more subtle than physical matter, but a kind of matter nevertheless. And when we feel and when we think, we shape that emotional and mental matter. We create forms, which are called thought forms, and we send them out into the world to influence other people. Well, Kandinsky was very much influenced by that book. We know he read it because he had a copy of the German translation of it, and he annotated his copy. And his copy, with his annotations in the margins, is still in existence. So we know he read it and was influenced by it. And in his work concerning the spiritual and art, Kandinsky says that the great calling of the artist is to influence humanity in more spiritual directions. And by spiritual, Kandinsky did not mean something vague and loosely emotional. He meant something very precise. By spiritual, Kandinsky meant increased awareness, increased consciousness. And Kandinsky thought that all of humanity was moving towards what he called the epoch of the great spiritual, when we would have an increased awareness of the world around us. And incidentally, that term, great spiritual, which Kandinsky used, is a literal translation of the Sanskrit term Mahabodhi. Mahabodhi, the great awareness, the great awakening, the great spiritual. And I think that Kandinsky intended by great spiritual the same thing that Madame Blavatsky refers to in The Secret Doctrine as Mahabodhi, the realm of the great awakening, or the great awareness, the great consciousness. Right, now, what I would like to do with you this evening is to look at some paintings to see some of this symbolic or spiritual content in them. And in order to sneak up a little bit on modern abstract art, which I think many people find difficult, we'll begin with some very old and very traditional representational paintings, right? And we'll look at some symbolic content in them. But in fact, some of the symbolic content will be the same as that which we will see a little bit later in the abstract paintings, because the representational paintings and abstract paintings deal with the same kind of symbolic spiritual meanings. So if we may start, we'll look at the first slide, which is a painting by the Spanish painter Murillo. And it is an example of quite traditional Christian symbolic art. This painting is called The Two Trinities. And knowing the title of a painting often helps very greatly with seeing its meaning. The two trinities in this painting are, first, the spiritual trinity, which is the Father, the Holy Ghost symbolized by a dove, and the Christ, right? The Son, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. And notice they form a vertical line. The second trinity in this painting is the human trinity of Mary, the mother, Joseph, the father, and Jesus, the son. And we have this human trinity which is on a horizontal, right? And that's important because this bit of symbolism we will see in a little bit in some paintings by a modern painter named Mondrian. The spiritual is a vertical line, the material is a horizontal line. And notice that in this painting, the horizontal line and the vertical line define between them a great upward pointing triangle, right? A triangle which points upward and hence is a spiritual triangle. I'm just pointing out these motifs, which we'll see again. All right, now here's another painting, and this is actually older than the Murillo we just saw. This is not a painting, actually. It's a tapestry. It's the unicorn tapestry. This is the central panel in that tapestry. And the unicorn, you all are familiar with unicorns, aren't you? A horse-like creature with a single horn in the center of its forehead. The legend about the unicorn is that it can be captured only by a virgin. And in Christian terms, therefore, the unicorn was taken as symbolizing Christ, and the virgin which captures the unicorn was taken as symbolizing the Virgin Mary. But it doesn't take much stretch of the imagination to realize that the Virgin Mary is also the Virgin Matter, right? Mary is matter, and the unicorn, which is Christ, is spirit. So we've got that same contrast of spirit and matter, which we saw in the earlier painting, here symbolized by the unicorn and the virgin which captures it, as matter captures spirit. This is rather a different one by the Spanish painter Velázquez, and it's called Venus at Her Toilet. And it's echoing some old classical themes. We've got the goddess Venus here looking into a mirror which is being held by her son Cupid and seeing her own reflection. Well, good heavens, there can't be anything symbolic in that, can there? Oh, yes, there is. Mirrors have traditionally been symbolic, and particularly the mirror of Venus is symbolic, as that into which we look and which reflects ourselves back. What is it that we look into and see ourselves in? Well, that's the mind. The mirror is symbolic of the mind. And I will remind you that in H.P. Blavatsky's marvelous little book, The Voice of the Silence, there is a line which says, "The mind is a mirror which gathers dust as it reflects." And so the mirror is the mind, and Venus, of course, is the goddess of love, emotion, passion, and through our emotions, our passions, our love, we reflect ourselves in the mirror of the mind. So just a little bit of symbolism there. Now, this is another painting which reflects a Greek myth. This is by the French painter Ingres, and I'm afraid it's rather dark. The painting is rather dark. So I'll tell you what's on it. If we look at it, you can see perhaps this figure of the human male there, can you? Standing with his arm up as though he's explaining something. And you may be able to see down here at his foot, there is a skull and some bones, rather grisly detail. And here you will have great difficulty seeing it, but there is a rock. And in the cleft of a rock, there lurks the Sphinx. The figure with body of a lion, wings of an eagle, and a human head. Now, this reflects a very ancient, and this is Oedipus, incidentally. The male figure is Oedipus from Greek mythology. There is a very ancient legend which says that on the road to Thebes, there was a cave in which the Sphinx lived. And the Sphinx stopped every passerby, every traveler, and asked the traveler a riddle. If the traveler could guess the Sphinx's riddle, it would let the traveler go on to Thebes. But if the traveler could not guess the Sphinx's riddle, the Sphinx pounced on the traveler and devoured him or her, and hence the bones. And incidentally, nobody had ever answered the Sphinx's riddle. Nobody had ever gotten by the Sphinx. Until Oedipus came along. And when he came by, the Sphinx asked the riddle, which was, "What is it which goes upon four legs in the morning, on two legs at noon and on three legs in the evening? And Oedipus was able to answer the riddle. The answer is man, humanity, which in the morning, who in the morning of life crawls on all fours, in the noontide of life walks upright on 2 feet, and in the evening of life walks with the aid of a cane. The Sphinx was so upset at having her riddle guessed that she threw herself off a cliff and was destroyed. In later years, André Gide, the modern French author, wrote a little story about Oedipus in later years. And someone asks Oedipus in Gide's story, "However did you guess the answer to that riddle when nobody else had ever done so?" And Oedipus replied, "Oh, it was easy. Because, you see, man is the answer to all riddles." All right. Now, the ones we've looked at so far are paintings whose meaning, whose symbolic meanings are traditional, come down to us from quite ancient times. The next group of paintings, I'm going to show you three by William Blake, mainly because I like Blake. But Blake did paintings full of symbolic meaning, but the meaning was often original with Blake. They're not so much traditional as unique meanings. This painting is called Elohim Creating Adam. And we see here the figure of Elohim hovering over the prone body of Adam, horizontal again, matter. And the body of Adam is circled around with a serpent, the Kundalini fire coming out of the earth, and Adam is being created. This is another painting by Blake, which is called Newton. And it is a portrait of the great physicist, the great English physicist, Newton. But notice what Blake has done. Newton is looking where? His eyes are directed down on the ground where he is drawing geometrical figures on the earth. But his eyes are firmly directed downwards. For Blake, Newton symbolized the mind, mental activity. And mental activity is directed out to the world of matter, or down, if one likes, upon the earth. It does not look up to the stars. And so Blake painted a, Blake painted a companion portrait. This is the Angel of Revelation. And here we have the figure of the angel, and notice his hand is pointed upwards in a gesture towards the sky. His eyes are directed upwards. The angel of the revelation is intuition, or that insight which is beyond intellect, in contrast with the Newton figure. Not only do we have traditional Western myths, but this is a painting by the French painter Paul Gauguin, and it's one of his series of Polynesian paintings, paintings he did in Polynesia. This is called The Moon and the Earth and reflects Polynesian legend. The male figure, the dark male figure, is the moon, and the female figure is the earth. And again, we're getting this contrast between spirit and matter suggested. And some modern painters, this is another French painter, Rousseau. Some modern painters like Rousseau do paintings which obviously are symbolic, obviously have a story, but we may not know what the story is. In the case of Gauguin, the painting we just saw, The Moon and the Sun. We may not know the myth behind this, but there is a Polynesian myth behind it, and Gauguin's interest in that primitive was part of the interest in the primitive which was sparked by theosophy. One of the things theosophy came along and said, one of the things Blavatsky said was that primitive peoples often have very highly developed spiritual traditions. And that was part of the reason why artists in the end of the last century, in the beginning of this, got interested in primitive art. Now, this painting, obviously by Rousseau, has behind it a story, though we may not know what it is precisely. We look at the painting, and what do we see? A female figure reclining in the midst of a great tropical, lush, astral-looking jungle. And clearly the female figure tends, very often does it not, to be symbolic of the soul. The Greek word psyche, which means soul, was in Greek mythology a young female, a young girl. And very often then, young girls are symbolic of the human soul. And in this great jungle with some lions lurking amid the lush flowers, there is also, if you can make it out, a figure. A black figure playing a flute. Anybody know what figure is dark or black in skin color and plays flutes? Actually, Krishna, right? Krishna, whose very name means the dark one or the black one, and who is depicted in Indian iconography as a flute player. So this figure almost seems to be Krishna, and Krishna represents in the Bhagavad Gita and in Indian writing generally, represents the spirit in us, the divine in us, the higher self. And so again, I suspect we've got that same theme of spirit and matter, right? Or of the higher self and the personality being joined in this wonderful, lush jungle, which is a kind of ASEAN world of illusion. All right, now, a change of mood. This is a painting. This is a painting by Paul Klee, which is called Cat and Bird. And obviously, it's a little joke. We can see the cat. Does anybody see the bird? There's the bird, right? And you see what this cat does? It has only one thing on its mind. The cat is concentrating on the bird. That's all it can think of. The bird is its mind. Well, surely this is not a symbolic painting, or is it? Do you and I ever find ourselves in the position when we're like a cat that has only one thing on its mind, when we find our minds utterly monopolized by a single thought, a single obsession? We're like the cat and the bird in those cases. Two paintings by Van Gogh. This one is called Cypresses, and it's simply a landscape, but a landscape with a difference, because in this picture, the cypress trees seem to be, do they not, alive with motion. Not only that, but the ground, the sky, the trees, the very mountains seem to be moving, right, to be alive. And Van Gogh here is expressing a very fundamental theosophical concept, namely that everything in the universe has life and consciousness and motion in it. And here's another Van Gogh painting which expresses exactly the same thing, perhaps even more effectively. This is Starry Night. And here the very heavens are moving, are swirling. The sky itself is alive with motion and vibration, right? As are the trees. Again, the cypresses. Now, here's a painting which is beginning to verge on the abstract. This is by a Czech painter named Kupka, and it is called The First Step. And in this case, we know something about why Kupka painted this picture. As a young man, Kupka had a mystical experience in which he felt himself to be in outer space, looking at the planets moving through the cosmos, moving in their great circles, great circular pathways through the cosmos. He had a sense, a mystical experience of the universal order of things. And he tried to capture that experience in some paintings, such as this one called The First Step. But one critic has looked at this painting, and this critic was not a theosophist at all, but he looked at this painting and he suggested that perhaps Kupka had another influence in this painting. Some of you may be familiar with a diagram which occurs in The Secret Doctrine and in Jina Rajadasa's First Principles and a lot of other places, the diagram of the globes of the earth chain. Some of you know that diagram? Well, it has been suggested that Kupka was influenced by that diagram in doing this painting. Now, we might as well go straight into abstract art. And if we're going to go, there's no point in sticking our little toe in the water and testing it. We might as well jump in, right? Get full immersion. So that's what we'll do. This painting is by Robert Ryman. It is called Twin, and it is, as you will recognize, a completely white canvas, right? With absolutely nothing on it. This is the ultimate in abstract art. And you may say, oh, well, surely that's only a joke. One goes into a museum and one sees these paintings that are solid canvases. Sometimes one can make out brush strokes on them. Sometimes, if they're really good, not even that. All one sees is the absolute white or black canvas. And you think, this is art? But let me suggest this is a very profound esoteric statement. Representational art, that art which depicts things we can recognize on the canvas, pictures surface appearances, does it not? It pictures things as the eye sees them. It pictures things as they are in this world. But are things as they appear to us, are things really as they appear to us in this world? Or is this world, as the Hindu tradition says, as the theosophical tradition says, as most spiritual traditions say, is this world really a world of illusion? So the surface appearances are false. Things are not the way they look to us, right? A painter, consequently, who paints the surface appearances of things is painting illusions. The painter with a spiritual impulse wants to get behind the surface to the esoteric reality underlying that surface. Now, that esoteric reality is clearly not going to look like anything we can recognize. Because if we can recognize it, it is the surface appearance and hence illusion. To get to the real essence, you have to go to something which does not look like what we can recognize. And if you want to get to the ultimate reality of things, what is the ultimate reality of things in the cosmos? What is that ultimate reality? Well, HPB talks about it in the proem to the Secret Doctrine, in which she says that the ultimate reality is the absolute, which is beyond all words, which cannot be described. It is unspeakable. It cannot be put into words. It cannot be put into pictures. So the ultimate reality must be something which has no characteristics, no form, nothing we can identify. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a picture of the ultimate reality. And I'm not just joking. The early abstract artists with a spiritual tendency were trying to do just that. They abstracted more and more until finally they came up with the completely white or completely black canvas, which represents the absolute. And here's another one, just so you don't think the absolute is always white. Here the absolute is dark blue. But now, here's another abstract painting dealing with these same great ultimates. This is by a painter named Reinhardt, and it's called simply Abstract Painting. But does this suggest anything to you by any chance? Those of you who are familiar with Madame Blavatsky's writings, her commentaries on the stanzas of Dzan, may recall that she says these very ancient archaic stanzas which describe the origin of the world, the birth of the cosmos, she says, were written upon a palm leaf manuscript in certain symbols. And the first symbol which she describes on that palm leaf manuscript is a white circle on a dull black ground. And that's exactly what we have in this painting. This painting is that symbol of the beginning of the cosmos before any birth of activity. Now, the next painting is by Barnett Newman. In fact, the next three paintings we'll look at are by Barnett Newman, a painter with very active spiritual interests and insights. These are abstract paintings that are trying to express some of these great cosmic concepts. This, incidentally, ignore all of this. That's not, the painting is just this white frame right here. And the painting is quite white, except that if you look very carefully, can you see a very faint yellow line right there? Can you make that out? That's the one bit of color on this white background. Now, let me tell you that Barnett Newman called this painting The Voice. The Voice. And that title is a clue to the meaning of the painting. What's the first thing which happens when the universe comes into manifestation? What's the first thing which appears? Well, Madame Blavatsky describes it symbolically as the point inside, the dot inside the circle. Newman is depicting it as this faint yellow line down one side of his white canvas. That is the manifestation of the Logos, right? The divine mind first coming into operation in the cosmos. And Logos means what? It's a Greek word which means literally the word, right? And the Sanskrit equivalent of the Logos is a Sanskrit word, vach. But vach means literally in Sanskrit, the voice. So in calling this painting The Voice, Barnett Newman was reflecting the Sanskrit word vach, which is the Logos, the first appearance of activity in the cosmos. Another Barnett Newman painting called Day One. And now what we've got is, in a black canvas, this great, brilliant red stripe indicating activity as the universe bursts into existence. And then Newman did a pair of paintings. These are huge paintings covering a wall almost as big as the size of the side of this room. Two paintings, one called Adam and one called Eve. And this is Adam. And these are complementary paintings which reflect one another and represent the two great primordial principles, right? Masculine and feminine in the universe. All right, these very abstract paintings then are difficult to understand, difficult to deal with often, but they do represent these great cosmic principles. Now let's go to a Dutch painter by the name of Piet Mondrian. And Mondrian was a member of the Theosophical Society all his life, and he declared that his paintings were theosophical paintings. And Mondrian was very disappointed because theosophists didn't like his paintings. And he thought that was too bad since he had painted them for theosophists especially and to illustrate theosophical ideas. Mondrian's paintings have a great similarity. Their basis is the vertical and the horizontal black lines on a white background. One wit remarked that Mondrian spent his whole life doing just one painting. He just kept trying to get it right. I'll show you three of them along here. But for Mondrian, the vertical line represents the spiritual, the horizontal line represents the material. Exactly those elements we saw in that early painting by Murillo, right? The two trinities. Exactly that same symbolic meaning. Here's another painting by Mondrian. This one adds the three primary colors of yellow, red, and blue. And for Mondrian, those three primary colors represented the three elements of matter, which in the Sanskrit tradition are referred to as gunas, the strands of matter in the universe, the three components of things. And this is another Mondrian painting. Actually, it's a rather early one. It's called Color Square in Oval. And we've got the same horizontal and vertical black lines. We have the same primary colors, although here rather muted into tints. But the whole thing is encased in a gigantic oval. And that oval represents the egg of the universe, right? The ring past knot, the boundary of the cosmos. And here we have all of the spiritual and material activities with the three colors, the three ingredients of the cosmos. And lest you think that this is something which is unique to Mondrian, here is a painting by the Cubist painter Georges Braque, which is called Oval Still Life with Violin. But notice it is in that same oval pattern indicating the cosmos. And we've got here the violin, which might signal to us the music of the spheres or the vibration, right? Everything in the universe is vibratory reality. And there's something else about this which is interesting. There is what appears to be a fragment of a newspaper or a piece of paper right up here. And can you read the letters written on that? D, U, O, duo. What does duo mean? Duality, double, twofoldness, right? And that's the spirit and the matter, the twofoldness in things. Another symbolic statement of this idea of universal harmony depicted in art. All right, this is the last painting Mondrian finished before he died in New York City. He came to New York City as a refugee during the Second World War. And this has got the same elements as all of his earlier paintings, vertical lines, horizontal lines, the three primary colors indicating the three constituents of matter. But this painting is quite different, isn't it? Whereas the other paintings were very stable, very steady, showed no change. This painting has in it, does it not, a great feeling of vitality and movement? Mondrian, at the end of his life, came to the conclusion that the world is not a static place. It is a dynamic place, a place of intense change and movement and becoming. And he was trying to capture that notion in this painting. All right, now we'll move to Kandinsky, the father of modern abstract art. And this is a very early Kandinsky painting. It is pre-abstract. It's a painting which was influenced by Russian folk art, which Kandinsky grew very fond of as a young man. And so it's a primitive painting, imitating primitive folk art. We see what are perhaps two great trees here, and in the foreground are several figures riding on white horses. But what I particularly want to call your attention to is this shape in the background, which is a blue mountain. And this painting is called Blue Mountain. And this blue mountain is very significant in Kandinsky. It's a favorite symbol of his. Kandinsky talks about it, in fact, in his book Concerning the Spiritual in Art. In that book, he says that humanity is like a great triangle with its point directed upward. Most of us, most of humanity, are at the base of the triangle. But at the apex of the triangle, at the point, are a few human beings who are in advance of the rest of the species. And those few human beings in the apex are constantly striving upward, constantly striving to reach new levels of spirituality, of consciousness, of awareness. And as they move up, they move the whole triangle with them, so that gradually through the eons, the whole triangle rises into greater understanding, greater awareness, greater spirituality. It's a result of the efforts of those at the apex. Now, that is a very theosophical notion, because those at the apex we call the great teachers of humanity, the Christs, the Buddhas, the great spiritual masters of the human race, whose activity brings all of us with them as we rise. And Kandinsky said that the color blue is symbolic of spirituality. Blue represented the spirit for Kandinsky. So the blue triangle then, the blue mountain, which is a triangle in shape, is a symbol of that spiritual rise. Now here's an early abstract painting by Kandinsky. Kandinsky's abstract paintings fall into three periods. This is from the first period, and my least favorite period, I must say. But this one is particularly interesting because it was during this period that Kandinsky was especially influenced by Besant and Leadbeater's book, Thought Forms. And I will direct your attention to this shape here, this black shape with its pointed claws coming out. Now, if you will look in Thought Forms, you will find a picture of a thought form described by Besant and Leadbeater, which is exactly like this. And that shape is said to be the shape of a thought of grasping. And black is the color of malice, according to that book. So this is malicious grasping. And here we have another shape, this gray one, which has that same claw-like fingers on it. And gray is the color of fear. So we get this fearful kind of shape in here. And here there's another shape, a little like a serpent rising to strike. This you will also find in Thought Forms. And this shape up here, you will also find in Thought Forms. These are all present, and their meanings are described by Besant and Leadbeater. And what Kandinsky has done, in fact, is to paint a picture of thought forms acting. And this picture and all of them from this period were painted in the years just before World War I. Right? And I think that very clearly Kandinsky was sensing the emotional turmoil in Europe at that time and recorded that turmoil on his canvases using these shapes that had been described by Besant and Leadbeater to depict the thoughts and emotions that he felt in Europe. Now, this is another painting by Kandinsky, which is from his middle period of abstraction, and you see how very different it is. Nice, clean, sharp lines. This painting is called Three Sounds, and don't you sort of get a feeling of music from this painting? Sort of from here? Little musical notes, harmonies? But I want to call your attention particularly to the three triangles in the center of the painting. And notice the largest of them, they are the primary colors, the three constituents of reality, but the largest of them is the blue triangle again, the blue triangle of spirituality. Now, this is my favorite Kandinsky painting, I think, of all. It is called simply Several Circles. But this painting, I think, is a perfectly marvelous, it's a big painting, a very large one, and I think it's a marvelous object for meditation. One can take and look at this painting, simply let oneself move into the painting. Notice the circles overlap one another, they blend. They are a picture of order and system and yet activity in the universe. Again, it's almost as if we are looking at the great globes of the cosmos moving inside one another. Or perhaps indeed the order and system inside ourselves. Wonderful picture for meditation. Another Kandinsky painting, which is called Development Upwards. Development Upwards. And notice we have got the horizontal lines which seem to divide the painting into planes. Right? And through them there moves a straight arrow going upward. And as one rises on the planes, things become more and more complex, more and more detailed, as indeed they must in the real planes of matter. This painting, I think, is a very interesting one theosophically. It is called Two Circles. And just look at the elements of the painting. We have here a yellow circle balanced by a red circle, and the yellow circle has by it a long line, and the red circle has a complementary one, and there's a little square there, balanced by a little square there, and this rather distorted triangle here by a complementary distorted triangle down there. We have here two design elements which are mirror images of one another, just exactly as spirit and matter are mirror images of one another. And I would suggest to you that that's what this painting is about. One side represents spirit, the other side represents matter. And what happens when you get spirit and matter together? What goes on between them when you get spirit and matter interacting? This tremendous electric interchange, which Madame Blavatsky refers to as Fohat, the force of life. Life springs from the interaction of spirit and matter. And I think that's what this painting is about. This is a painting from Kandinsky's third period, and it's called simply Stripes. And notice what we've got is a series of black and white stripes alternating. And of course, black suggests night, doesn't it? Or death, or dissolution, or lack of activity. And white suggests day, or life, or activity, or manifestation. And across this canvas move shapes which seem almost to be living shapes, shapes of living creatures, like nothing we recognize in the world, but living beings of some kind. And they move through manifestation and through dissolution to manifestation to dissolution and onwards. It makes no difference whether we have pralaya or manvantara, activity or rest, life continues.
continues. It continues its great movement forward.
All right, for the last Kandinsky painting I'm going to show you, this is a relatively early one. Again, it's one which is just before he moved into his abstract period, but it is in many ways a very telling painting and a very interesting one. Just look at it for a moment and see if you can see anything in this painting. This, in fact, is not an abstract painting. This painting shows things. Can you recognize anything in it? All right, you see a building here? Yes, there's a building. Right. Anything else? You see a rainbow. Yes, a rainbow here. And there is what may be a sun here, a rising sun. Yes, what have we have here a mountain, but not just a mountain. What kind of mountain? A blue mountain. Now, this painting was, as a matter of fact, a study for the left half of a much larger painting. And in the larger painting, the blue mountain is completed. We see the whole mountain. Here we see only half of the mountain. We've got that blue mountain, the symbol of spirituality. Anything else you recognize in this painting? Guns or artillery. Very good. Are you thinking about these or these? Yes. Those are curious things. Hard to say. Perhaps they are guns or artillery. They could be several things. All right. We see some birds up here. Right? Looks like flying birds. Right? Anything else? Y'all are doing marvelously. Yeah. You know, I'd never seen that in the painting. Now that you point it out, I can see that too. These are wonderful. This kind of painting is a wonderful thing because we can see different things in it, all right? And that's just fine. Let me tell you what this painting hangs in the Tate Museum in London. And let me tell you what the Tate Museum curators call this painting. It's not what Kandinsky called it, but they call the painting Cossacks. Cossacks. Now, maybe we can see something else if you know that. There are here, on this side of the painting, three human figures who are Cossacks. They wear red hats. They are dressed in white robes. Two of them are holding lances. They're their yellow hands holding the lances. And the third one holds a sword, which he has pointed downward. You all see the Cossacks? All right, now, over here, the Tate Museum says there are two other Cossacks. There are their red hats, and they are holding purple scimitars, swords, and they are mounted on horses, on white horses. Here is one white horse, and here is the other white horse, and the white horses are locked in combat, in fight. Can you all see that when I point it out? All right, now, Kandinsky, however, called this painting not Cossacks, but Schlacht. Kandinsky used German most of his adult life, and Schlacht means strife or combat. And that reinforces this theme here. But there's something peculiar about this painting. It doesn't really seem to be a very violent painting. For one thing, its colors are light and bright and clear. For another thing, even these Cossacks who are soldiers do not, if we ignore these two for a moment, all right? These over here don't seem to be very aggressive, do they? Their lances are not held in a threatening position, which would be horizontally, that is to say, the plane of matter, right? Rather, the lances are held vertically, which is not a threatening position at all. That's the spiritual position, isn't it? The vertical line. And furthermore, those lances run right up and out of the painting. So they direct our eyes upward and outward. And these Cossacks are standing in front of what? The Blue Mountain, the hill of spirituality. Right? So somehow we don't see. And what about rainbows, for heaven's sakes? The rainbow is the promise of an agreement between the divine and the human. Remember the biblical story of how rainbows came about? After the flood was over, God put a rainbow in the sky,
as the sign of his covenant with humanity, that the world would never again be destroyed by water. So the rainbow is a sign, a symbol of peace and agreement and harmony. And Kandinsky himself made some notes on this painting, and in those notes he said that this painting was intended to show the resolution of opposites, the resolution of conflict. And now we come to the thing in the painting which I think shows that most clearly. Nobody called this out, but I wonder, does anybody looking at this part of the painting, before I told you they were two Cossacks mounted on white horses, did anybody see a bird here? Did anybody see a great white bird? And if you did not, can you see the bird now? Here is its head. Here is one wing. Here is the other wing. It is the white dove of peace brooding over the rainbow. Right? Can you see the white dove in that? I think that was intentional in Kandinsky's part. He painted something which can be seen as two Cossacks struggling in battle, fighting, but which looked at another way becomes the dove of peace, resolves the conflicts. Now, this is a great spiritual theme because we live in a world of conflicts. Matter and spirit are conflicting with one another, are fighting. Everywhere we look, we see combat and opposition. And what we must do is to find a way to harmonize that conflict, to transcend those oppositions, to synthesize the fight, and to make out of it peace and harmony. And that, I think, is what this painting by Kandinsky does. It takes elements of combat and transforms them into the symbol of peace, and particularly the great dove, the rainbow of promise, the hill of spirituality. In many ways, then, I think this painting is perhaps one of the great theosophical statements which Kandinsky made, that out of the struggle of this world can come the peace and the enlightenment and what he called the epic of the great spiritual. It will not happen of itself. We must make it happen. And we make it happen by seeing the world not as a collection of conflicts, but as a statement of great peace and order and harmony. It is up to us. We are the world. You and I make it up. That's a statement which Krishnamurti once said, and it's a very true one. We are the world. We make it up. And what we think and do and feel will become what the world thinks and does and feels. Because apart from us, there is no world. We sometimes think we are helpless in the environment around us, but that's not so. Because every thought we have, every feeling we have, affects that environment. And you and I have the power within us to change the world. And that's what Kandinsky is saying in this painting. We can transform the strife into peace and harmony. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.